The democratic process was born in the time of ancient Greek civilization. Demos was the Greek word for the people. The Greeks trusted their politicians even less than we do today. Thus, the first politicians were commissioned by their electors and warned that if they failed to represent their people, they would be decapitated. In one Greek state, in Locria, any politician who wished to introduce a new law had to stand in the forum with a rope round his neck. If the law was accepted, he was acclaimed and congratulated. If, however, it was rejected, he was promptly strangled. Harsh though this may have been, it ensured that laws were kept to a minimum and that those in operation were widely approved. The parliamentary representative in Britain originally followed the same principles. There were no political parties for hundreds of years after the birth of the British Parliament. The politician, for a long period of history, gave his services voluntarily, as in sections of local government today. Parliament met infrequently and passed few laws. Members voted according to their consciences, and they had ample opportunity to consult with those they represented. They were thus respected as leaders imbued with the idea of service, and the laws they passed made for a better society. Thus, whilst mistakes were made, democracy flourished and expanded, and the British parliamentary system became the model for other nations. The original British parliamentary system was inspired by the system of government in the Church of England. At the time of the birth of King Alfred the Great, there were five kingdoms in England, and the one over which he became king was Wessex. At that time, the only national organisation in England was the church, and the church government had adopted a relatively representative approach. The church synod, the bishops, and the Archbishop of Canterbury had enormous authority in spiritual matters. Other citizens and groups were also represented in the courts of the church. These included the knights, the commons, the townsfolk, and many different classes of Englishmen. Whatever the authority of the Archbishop, it was quite useless if exercised in a vacuum, and therefore, wisely, maximum involvement and representation had been sought from the various estates in England. When England became a united kingdom, it again drew upon the example of the church and evolved the concept of a House of Lords, which represented lords both temporal and lords spiritual, and of course the House of Commons. By the end of the 20th century, most Westerners are aware that the prospect of real choice in their democracies is limited, whenever the major political parties find it in their interest to do so, of course. For example, in Australia, where over 60% of the print media is owned and dominated by one man, it has simply not been possible for any political party to oppose that arrangement without suffering heavy retribution. This has happened not so much over the immediate issue of decentralising control over the media, but the party's fear being badly treated by the media on almost all other issues until they capitulate to the media moguls. Increasingly, the citizens' choice has been limited through so-called bipartisan policies. In certain areas, all parties may agree to the one single policy. This happens over an enormous range of policy areas, from immigration to airline policy, and in so doing, it has shifted the real focal point of power out of parliaments and into the smoke-filled party rooms, which are often totally influenced by vested interests involved in various issues. Politicians, of course, to a man, will deny this increasing suspicion on the part of citizens. However, the tremendous shock that politicians receive at or about the time of retirement, with the sudden realisation that they are again to rejoin the human race, has produced a surprising number of shocked confessions from retiring and former politicians. We shall quote you just a few. When Mr. Charles Faulkender, a Liberal member from Tasmania, was retiring, in his final parliamentary speech, he said that the relationship between the Cabinet and the Parliament was gradually but surely militating against parliamentary democracy. Members were giving away their right to express their views on what became law, he said. The trouble was that members sublimate their minds to the wish of the party. Once elected members of parliament are bound to vote on party lines, the fate of the man who tries to pursue an independent course is pretty certain. The result, said Mr. Faulkender, after 20 years of the system, is that Parliament, as such, has lost real touch and ability to be a law-making force. Mr. Frank Green, the former clerk of the Australian Federal Parliament House, previously quoted, said in brief, "With increased party organisation and discipline, the initiative of the private member has gone. It has divided Parliament into two disciplined forces. Neither party is anxious to discuss the issue fully, for fear that such discussion would reveal its own inner divisions." Professor Bland, a former Liberal member for Warringah, once put it, "Parliamentarians could save their electors a great deal of money by staying at home and merely sending a telegram when their votes were needed." Unquote. A former Tasmanian senator, R.J.D. Turnbull, wrote, "There are few individuals in Australia who do not believe that politicians are out for themselves. And personally, I have yet to find a politician not prepared to change his political opinion if he found it would otherwise affect his chances of re-election, upon which he is dependent for the goodies of political life." That observation is confirmed when it is associated with the truism that in all so-called safe seats, it is the party nomination that ensures your election. When the Australian Labor MP, Mr. Clyde Cameron, was retiring in 1980, he said, "We've got an elected dictatorship. We haven't got a parliamentary democracy in the proper sense of the word. The parliamentary system has been completely frustrated by the need for parliamentary expediency." Just after the British parliamentarian Mr. John Pardo retired, he wrote, "The majority of MPs have shown no stomach for controlling the executive. They have steadfastly refused to do the job they are there to do, and have occupied their time with other things." Even if an MP does try to do his job of controlling the executive, there is the full weight of the party against him. If he seriously embarrasses his government by questioning its actions, he will soon be told that he has been elected to support his party and not make life difficult for it. In all Western parliaments, the increase in sheer volume of legislation has been an enormous problem. Perhaps as one of the younger Western nations, the Australian example is the most dramatic. From the birth of the nation in 1901 to 1905, the Australian Commonwealth passed an average of 20 acts per year. It has now soared above 300 per annum. It is no different with any other parliament in the Western world. As one political commentator has observed, "The acceleration of legislation did not necessarily mean parliaments worked harder. It did mean that more politicians had to vote on measures that they did not understand, nor had even the time to read." An example of the dilemma in which citizens find themselves was instanced when a citizen asked a senator, "Tell me, Senator, if your party becomes the government, what will its policy be on China?" "I am ashamed to say," replied the senator, "that my party is committed to the recognition of communist China and the withdrawal of all recognition from Taiwan, with which we have had a long and amicable relationship, for the mutual benefit of the two countries." "Well then," the citizen asked the senator, "how can you stand for public office on a policy which you believe to be wrong?" "That's politics," replied the senator. "Compromises have to be made." A heated debate took place in the street amongst departing members of the audience. Some said it would be wrong to vote for a senator standing on a policy he knew to be wrong. Others said, "We must vote for him because the other party is even worse." We asked a sample of citizens to consider a rather idealised view of what an ideal representative should be. The types of ideas we put forward are as follows, and we'd like you to consider whether you agree with them.
I would like an honest representative, a person who would judge each issue, each act and bill upon which he was to vote, with a clear and unfettered conscience, voting accordingly. Such a person would never, absolutely never, vote upon an issue which he had not had time to study and consider from all angles. He would regard any attempt to interfere with his conscience as an unlawful and immoral intrusion and improper interference with his duty.
My representative's conscience would be tempered by two important things. Firstly, his own belief in what is right and wrong, and secondly, the will and the requirements of his electors. If it was clear that a majority of his electors wanted something he considered to be wrong, and no reconciliation of views between his electors and himself could be achieved, he would always feel it his duty to resign. He would allow no party pressure or inducement to interfere with his total commitment to these two facts.
My ideal representative would have a clear understanding of those things which are not the province of Caesar, and would resist the temptation to involve government in areas where it does not belong.
And my ideal representative would undertake to resign if an agreed percentage of his electors petitioned him to do so.
My ideal representative would refuse to fix his own salary and expenses by voting on them in Parliament, but would seek means whereby his electorate had some say in what he received.
My ideal representative would act impartially for all those he represented, refusing unfairly to penalise or favour some individuals over others.
My ideal representative would consider himself the servant of his people, which, in its right context, is the most honourable station to which anyone can aspire.
And my ideal representative would seek the best means possible to meet and consult with all interests in the electorate as frequently as possible.
My ideal representative would at any stage be much more interested in repealing the mountain of conflicting, confusing and often oppressive regulations and legislation resulting from years of over-government rather than adding to what had already been passed.
Above all, my ideal representative would insist that the bureaucracy had no place in policy making, either in the political or the economic fields, and it must return to its true function of administration, leaving policy in the hands of the people.
Whilst these are rather idealised views, most people were found to suggest something similar. Well then, what is to be done about gaining better representation? In truth, hundreds of suggestions could be made. In this segment, we are going to examine three in detail. Before we go into these suggestions, we should resolve to get off the political merry-go-round. We must stop voting for the lesser of numerous evils. If we don't stop this irresponsible behaviour, we may find that our vote is not for democratic representatives, but whether or not we should be boiled in oil or shot at dawn.